In the culture war, there are no winners, just podcasters. Only a few are willing to risk their lives in the face of some of the dumbest ideas to have ever captured human civilization. Every week, we, Megan Dom and Sarah Hayter, humbly accept this mission to bring you conversations that are equal parts stunning, brave, and below replacement level. Welcome to a special place in hell. Sarah, I feel like we were just here.
We were. That's why you.
Yeah.
We're always here. In my mind, this is where we always are.
It's kind of like Severance. Have you seen the show Severance? Mm-mm. Which is about severing people's cognition between their workplace and their home life. When they're at work, they have absolutely no idea who they are at home and vice versa. So I feel like we're approaching that.
Mm-hmm.
We should say that we recorded day before yesterday and it fully sucked. We're redoing it.
Yeah. And who knows how this is going to go, but that one sucks. We just didn't have any steam, you know, and I didn't have my cough syrupy pep going on.
Oh, your pseudoephedrine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I also had, something wrong with my foot and I wasn't sure what it was. And it was like the minute we hit record, a thought came into my mind that I might have gout and that I had the symptoms of gout. Because all I know about gout is that it's in your foot and it comes on all of a sudden and it's really painful. And the entire time we were recording, I was like, oh my God.
Were you in pain?
A little bit. But okay. I was like, oh my God.
Sorry.
Oh my, well, no, that wasn't the problem. But I was so distracted and upset by this like sudden notion that I had gout and I couldn't Google it. Like if we hadn't been recording, I would have just like Googled it and found out what I found out after we finished recording, which is that I don't have gout. It's likely a stress fracture. But it was just like one of those things.
That
I just came up the whole, I just like internally. Like,
how'd you fracture it?
I don't know. Actually, I don't know. That's the thing is like nothing in particular happened, but I've been having this weird, it feels like a bone pain the top of my foot. Mm. And, anyway, this is not so riveting, but that's my excuse for being a little checked out.
Well, that's a good excuse. Last time I have no excuse. I just was checked out, but look at us. Here we are doing it again.
This
we could have just
do.
Released it. We could have just released it.
And we could have, and they wouldn't have known the difference.
That we're not going to talk about the Guernica thing?
We talked about the situation with the literary journal Guernica. This was a big story week before last, having to do with this journal retracting a very beautiful essay by a writer named Joanna Chen about being in Israel and Gaza and, you know, the threading the needle of empathy. And she had volunteered transporting kids from Gaza from Palestine, from the West Bank into Israel for medical treatment. And anyway, she was very much like a good person, that she wrote a nuanced essay and it was hated upon by the masses, AKA 12 loud people on Twitter, and the magazine took it down. Several people wanted us to comment on this. I think enough time has passed that we don't need to, and you can imagine what we think. But if they're interested, they can go to my Substack. I did a post about it the other day. It's called The Literary World Has Been Captured, I don't know what it's called. The Arts Have Been Captured, and Only Artists Can Lead Us Out. So they can read what I have to say there. I don't know what else we talked about, but we've got better stuff now.
Yeah, for a while.
We should tell people that we are having a hangout for founding members this coming Sunday, March 23rd at what time? At 5 p.m. Pacific.
Yeah,
8 p.m. Excuse
so
me.
Late
March
for me.
24th. Excuse me. March 24th. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And we're going to do another live stream on Monday, April 1st at 4 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Sorry, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. Got it?
Oh, my God. No, I don't got it. I'm confused. So
4 p.m. Pacific for me, 7 p.m. Eastern for you. live stream.
All right.
Okay.
Cool. So lots coming up. And then what are we talking about today?
I don't know. You had your undies all in a bunch about something.
Undies?
I'm just trying not to say panties because that's a gross word.
That is a gross word, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like underwear. I prefer it.
You have your underoos all in a bunch about population collapse, which I know is one of your bugaboos.
You sent me a New York Times Ezra Klein show podcast episode, which was so long.
And sorry.
I didn't listen to all of it.
Try not to send you anything longer than a tweet.
Transcript. Okay, look, I do read a lot of books. There's this midpoint of magazine article length, like really long magazine article length, that really tries my patience because it never gets in deep enough that I feel as if I have reached some like new epiphany, like they've really come up with something incredible and now I know the answer to something I didn't answer.
There's no answers. You're waiting for the answer. You're going to be waiting for a long time.
That I have knowledge. Well, actually, I read, I tried to read a million years ago this book by a social critic, sociologist, lots of things. I mean, he's an intellectual, I mean, dead now, but named Philip Reif. Who wrote, he was kind of a scholar of Freud. And then he wrote about that and wrote about also our therapeutic age, what he calls our therapeutic age. And his seminal work is a book called Triumph of the Therapeutic, which I purchased many, many years ago, started it, found it really difficult. And at that time, not that interesting. So I moved on and picked it up again a couple of months ago and have just been like amazed at what it's doing to me. Like I just feel radically transformed by this book. You know, when you like read something where their view of the world, like, and their assumptions are so radically different than anything you've found before. And now you're pulled into this perspective, this other perspective, you know, and it feels as if you can barely talk to people who don't share this perspective anymore. You know what I mean? Like that my whole language of cultural criticism has shifted closer to his view, except nobody knows what his view is, but a few people. And this book is out of print. I tweeted about it. People tried to get it. It's like $800 if you try to get it in Canada, evidently. Oh. And like, $150 or something if you try to get it here. I must have gotten one of the last prints of a new print, so I got lucky there. So I'm sorry you can't have access to this incredible information, Megan, but yeah, anyway, I'll read that. You know, I'll read that. It'll make a difference in my, you know, internal world. Magazine articles almost never do. Having said that, we are going to discuss this podcast a little bit.
Okay. Wait, I need to say something about Philip Reif. Can I say something about Philip Reif?
Sure.
Do you know this? So do you know that he was married to Susan Sontag?
Yeah, of course.
And do you know how old she was when they got married?
Yeah, very young. And she was like, and she 17. Had a kid. She had a kid at 19 or something,
and she,
right?
David Reif, that's right. Mm-hmm. And she was his. She was Philip Reif's student, I believe.
Yeah, there's but
Susan Sontag was quite the mother. This actually is a good segue. She always said, I don't cook for David. I warm for him. Aww. She would put the food in the oven and warm it. So that was nice.
Yeah. She had a kind of an interesting shift too. Like towards the end of her years, she became a little bit more, I mean, as they all do. A little bit more conservative by the end of it. But it seemed like they had a good relationship towards the end, until the end, though. Mm-hmm. I've been reading a lot of his works ever since then.
Okay.
And it's great. It's changing things in me. And now you're going to see a whole new Sarah.
The Philip Reifization of Sarah Hayter. Okay. I sent you this podcast interview on the Ezra Klein show with a demographer named Jennifer Shuba. I think that's how you pronounce it, S-C-I-U-B-B-A. I thought it was really interesting about why people are having fewer children. And I know this is a concern of yours.
Is there anything that they were talking about that surprised you, though? Like,
Well, I mean, Ezra sort of approaches this from the point of view that I approach it from, which is that I don't know how concerned to be about this. Like, I think we all now accept that Paul Ehrlich's catastrophism with the population bomb was wrong, and that we are at below replacement level in many places in the globe. But I'm still a little bit confused as to how big of a problem it is or isn't. And I say this with no agenda. I honestly don't know. I don't care what the answer is. I just don't know what the answer is.
Yeah. I think it does. So we were discussing this a little bit privately right before recording. And I think that a lot of like the attitude that you take up when it comes to a conversation like this is a lot more about ultimate values and how you feel about humanity in general. Because I think that that's one of the differences that you and I have, that you feel a lot more empathetic about humanity in general. And like, are we, well, will we exist in like 200 years, 300 years? Maybe not. Maybe this just animals. I feel like you're much more sanguine about humanity disappearing, and I'm less.
I don't. Sanguine is the word. I'm not as bummed out by it. Mm-hmm. Look, I think 200, 300 years, we're still going to be here. I'm not really worried.
But what
about
if
that.
We weren't?
Look, I mean, this is one of these things where, like, I'm personally an antinatalist and publicly a pronatalist, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It doesn't affect, I don't care, but my opinion, this is always the thing of my opinion. I'm so out of step with most people that it doesn't matter what my opinion is. It's funny that I've made my career having opinions when ultimately I don't think that they're that important.
Well, I do think that, like, oh, that's interesting. I don't want to get sidetracked by that little sentence of yours at the end. It was very enticing. But I wonder if it's just, if you had kids, would you then be more concerned? Because it necessarily means that.
Yeah, I'm sure I would be.
Your great grandchildren maybe died.
Look, yes, I would be. Although I still don't know if I would see it as like something to think about beyond the next 500 years. If I had kids right now, I don't think I would be terribly worried about their future. If I had kids now, they would be older. They would be, you know, at least in high school, and they would need to live another 70 years. And I think we'll be fine in 70 years.
Maybe they have kids of their own, and then you need to worry
wouldn't.
About a little.
They wouldn't, no, they because wouldn't. They would hate me so much that they would say what they would say. I'm not having kids. Like, I don't know. Look, it's like I'm not. I can only talk about this objectively because my personal framing is so aberrant. It doesn't matter. Like, you know, my parents should not have had kids. I don't have kids. My brother doesn't have kids. Our side of the family tree is gone. It's fine. I have no negative feelings about that. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't expect other people to understand that. I certainly don't expect them to do the same thing. I'm not advising people to think like I do. It's just how it is.
I see what you're saying in terms of that feeling of distance from humanity 500 years from now, that is, I mean, it's they're so abstract that even if they were related to me, I'm not sure how much I would care, you know, about my descendants that far down the line, who I don't even know. I think up until like the grandchildren level, I would still care because presumably I would have met them.
Yeah.
And I would know them and love them and want some kind of life for them. But then beyond that, you know, faceless, nameless strangers, doesn't matter so much. I don't know, but I guess the reason that it does bother me thinking about population collapse or decline. Collapse is how many some people are putting it, but maybe, you know, maybe that's too extreme. Maybe it's not going to be that bad. But the problem with it is that it brings a lot of pain as it happens. And since we have never experienced this specific thing before, like this is new in humanity's history.
In all of human civilization, there has not been a population collapse and then rebuilding. I honestly don't know.
But that's different though. A plague comes and destroys a certain amount of people like that, but that is a different kind of event. It has different causes. It has this external cause that comes and then goes. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, it's not insidious to people.
It's not it's not generation after generation.
Right.
You know, right. So there are demographic shocks, many, many, many that have happened and some that we have a lot of good written records about. You know, just in modern European history, you can take a look at the plague and, you know, Irish famines and stuff like that and see what has happened, you know, immediately after the shock, you know, and it also depends so much on the what the shock is, you know, like if it's a kind of a disease and who it happens to target. If it happens to target a lot of old people, well, that's one thing, and that has different effects. And if it happens to target a lot of young people and children, or if it just targets weak people in general, you know, so there's a lot of just even within what's the category of the shock, or like what kind of shock is it, and then, you know, who the particular circumstances of who died or who was more vulnerable to it, all of that is, you know, all of these are variables that reflect in the way, you know, and the speed of recovery afterwards of a demographic shock. So that there's a lot of like interesting literature there that one can explore if you were so inclined, but they are not like what we're experiencing now, you know? So there's, we can learn some things, I think, you know, maybe they, but there's also the possibility that we will be misled by them because the nature of this external thing, a war, a plague, a natural disaster is different than what it is that we're seeing today.
Okay. Okay, so what do you foresee? Like, what does this catastrophe look like to you, theoretically, in 200 years?
Yeah, I mean, I hesitate to go into details, and maybe we should bring somebody who is, you know, this is their specific,
I would love to. I would love to have Jennifer Shuba on, if she will come on.
Yeah.
I would love to talk to her.
Maybe it's Squeeba. It could
I don't think that's the way to entice her to come on.
Okay, but well,
it's not
maybe you're mispronouncing it. It could
not
be. Where's the H?
I think it's Shuba. Well, because I think that's how you put those letters together. Anyway, I would love to have her on or somebody to school us on this.
But I think for me, my understanding is pretty broad and not like, you know, deeply knowledgeable on any one aspect of it, but I am worried about our pension systems not being able to, like, just collapsing under the weight of the stress that necessarily a whole bunch of old people and very few young people will put on them. Mm-hmm. And we have seen what happens in sort of, you know, kind of minute situations. Like, you can even take a look at, like, examples of small towns that have, granted pensions to a great many people within that town, but the scheme wasn't very intelligent and the town didn't really grow. And so there weren't enough young people. So the city tries to tax more of the younger people, tax them more and more in order to make up for
the amount of
money that it
needs.
You've
got towns filled with old people. Yeah.
But then the young people leave.
Right.
Because they don't want to pay that many taxes. And so you have shrinking the base that keeps shrinking until you have essentially a collapse and, you know, a town or a city or whatever that it can do nothing but, you know, put all its money into pensions, put all its money into the old and keeping up with the old and can't maintain the roads, can't do basic, simple governance you know, the kind of utilities that we depend on the government because it has this huge debt to pay
off.
And
also has a lot of poor people. I mean, what you're describing is what a lot of rural America is like. I mean, there's a brain drain. So it's not just old people. It's the poor people who are left. So there's not a lot of money going in.
Neither they're left there. Yeah. And then they then you just see a little, you know, a little locale disappear, you know, just collapse with the weight on top. And it's a miserable way to go. You know, I can't imagine that being one of these old people that worked, you know, you worked your whole life, you planned for this pension, you thought you were going to get this pension, you did get it to some degree, but everything around you, your town is collapsing, your government can't take care of, you know, basic things that you need, the amount of money coming in your bank account decreases, you know, month by month, year by year, and you look forward to a very lonely and possibly deprived like old age. It's a terrible, I mean, that's it.
This is what I'm planning for. What you describe is literally what I am planning for.
You're planning to blow your brains out, though. I mean, kind of, I
don't know if I don't know if blowing my brains out, but no, I mean, look, I do think about, you're sounding awfully socialist. I mean, I have a retirement account. I mean, I do think about how much is in my retirement account because I know I'm not going to, Social Security is not going to cover it. And I'm very aware.
Wait, how's that socialist, though?
But you're not. And a free marketer would say people need to save, and you know, they not rely on the government and forget about your pension.
Oh well, I'm not saying that the government should take care of like these people more, because where is it going to come from? Where's the money going to come
from? But we shouldn't have been relying upon it in the first place, is what a lot of people would say.
We shouldn't have been giving them those kinds of pensions in the first place. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I mean, that's one way to spin it. But I'm actually not focused on that at all. I'm just thinking about the fact that this has been the way that human societies have been structured forever. We have always presumed growth, like population growth, or at the very least replacement. And now that we don't have that, there is, you know, a kind of, you know, promise of between generations of burdens that is taken on by generations that is broken. And it is unfair to the next youth, you know, the next generation of young people, that they will bear a very great burden because their parents didn't want to bear theirs. And I think it's sad. And it isn't just like an economic problem, which it is very likely going to be an economic problem. Saving can only take you so far, because if the country's economy starts collapsing, it doesn't matter how much the investments you have. This is imaginary money, you know, like it can disappear if the government that is the center focus of this currency starts to collapse and become unstable. Like what? Okay. That won't mean anything either.
Again, I don't know enough about this. I mean, I don't know how much the immigration piece, I don't know how that plays out.
It's global, though.
I get it.
If temporarily we bring in some immigrants that have some more babies, ultimately we're all going to end up in that one place, which is
so maybe lower. It's inevitable. Okay, but maybe there is some existential logic to mm-hmm. people's lack of desire to reproduce. Maybe this is an end stage civilization. Sometimes it feels that way.
Yeah, I you know, and they're just, so the optimistic note, to the extent that there is one in this conversation, is that it could be the case that technological shifts, like massive ones, make a big difference here. Like it could be the case that we make a big breakthrough with, you know, AI or whatever, or energy production, and we just need less labor to, you know, make sure that the economy is running. We just need less humans mm-hmm. to make sure that the economy is running. And, you know, that is totally possible and something we should be striving for still, you know, in addition to also trying to repair this on a population level, on a human level. So maybe it won't be that bad. And maybe it won't be that devastating. Or maybe it would be very devastating to a certain, you know, class of people, but some people will survive and it'll be fine for them. I just, it's, what got me going about this piece, and you mentioned, so there's this podcast, it's very long, it's interesting, but it doesn't really cover anything that we haven't covered in this podcast before, in our podcast before. But then there's the comments that you pointed to.
New York Times reader comments.
Pissed me like them. Off. They don't always piss me off. Like sometimes I'm like surprised and happy about New York Times comments. And then this time they just pissed me off. Did you have any good ones that you liked?
I mean, a lot of it is just the classic, you know, in an overcrowded world with diminishing resources, why are we even trying to, quote, replace the population? Why is that a catastrophe? You know, a lot of people are stuck in the Paul Ehrlich.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that.
They have like not gotten the memo.
Yeah. 50% of the commentators just don't seem to know that actually was just a bunch of BS. And you need to stop worrying about that particular problem. It's not only is it not the problem, the opposite is the problem. And then there's like these climate activists that.
Yeah.
That,
here's a good one. Can I read this one? Yeah. Wait, is this what? Okay, so this is somebody in North Carolina. I was getting a bite to eat at a local luncheonette counter recently when the woman sitting next to me struck up a conversation. I had mentioned that I had moved here from California, and she asked me why. I said climate change, and she immediately understood. Immediately. She said she and her husband had also moved here from the Georgia coast for the same reason. This is North Carolina, by the way. Again. So the conversation turned to climate change, and after a bit, she mentioned that she's a climate scientist studying the carbon cycle of the ocean and how single-celled creatures affect it. She said she and her husband had decided years ago not to have children because she could see what was coming. As impacts continue to intensify, more and more people will come to the same decision. The climate change reason for not having kids is interesting because I've been talking about the decision to not have kids for couple decades now. And I used to say that anybody who said that they weren't having kids because of climate change was lying. They were just looking for an excuse. And I think that was probably true up until 10 years ago or so. I think that climate alarmism has infiltrated, you know, the rising generations enough to that they do actually take that very seriously. But depending on the age of this person, I don't buy it. I mean, it's such a taboo to say I'm not having kids because I just don't want them that people will come up with excuses. Right.
I think that this is not a real problem. It's just an excuse that allows us to like do with more honor to do something.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds better than I'd rather have expensive shoes, you know.
Right. Or just parenthood sounds really tough and I don't want to do that to myself, you know. I don't want to do that to my body. I don't want to do that to my marriage or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll like this one. Okay. This person says, maybe it's the climate or the authoritarianism sweeping the world. Maybe it's food insecurity, housing insecurity, health insurance. What about health care? Going to further debt by a child thrown into the mix. No way. It's actually pretty easy to understand why birth rates are falling. In the U.S., where women are treated like second-class citizens, area where we say, no, I'm not having a baby under these conditions. Okay. This person did get schooled in the replies. Okay. So,
well, because they deserved it. And I think that this is where, I think in the podcast, there were moments where Jennifer Shuba?
I'm going to say
Squeeba. where she, you know, touched on the differences in values and culture that we now have and that prosperity has really allowed us to have. You know, like it wasn't the case that it wasn't always the case that you could survive without having children, and now you don't really need them. You don't really need them in old age. So there's a prosperity angle to all this, and also that we have a lot of options of what to do with our time in a way that we didn't before, and that plays into the calculus. And we shouldn't feel bad about having those options, and we shouldn't feel bad about, you know, taking those options really and enjoying life. But it isn't this we're so deprived and that's why we don't have kids. Yeah. I don't even understand how people can continue to say this despite literally all evidence to the contrary. Like I don't know how many charts to give people. I don't know how to fix this, how to correct for this particular myth, because I can just show, I can show people charts of like, here is a very prosperous country and here is a not so prosperous country, and look at the differences in fertility rates. And it's exactly the opposite relationship as what you would expect if it was true that this is the reason why people don't have kids. And it's the same within the country too. You can look at in the country itself, and you can take a look and compare, you know, comforts, like creature comforts and children. And it's not what you think. But that's not to say that it isn't the case that we are making a, you know, we are taking a look at children and thinking about them as an investment in our time, you know, in our limited time that we have on this earth. And I think that is actually the resource that we don't have enough of that makes us feel as if there's a scarcity problem, which is not, that is never discussed. Like, people don't want to talk about it because it's just not, yeah, I don't think it's the first thing that people think about, but clearly that's what's,
you mean it's time as opposed to expense. Like, they can get their minds more easily around, I people don't want to have children because they've been told that what's important is prosperity and protecting your assets and achieving and having nice things. I mean, this is like capitalism.
Right. And which is why you kind of see, so you see the very, very wealthy people, they start to, their fertility rates increase.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they're, yeah. So it's kind of a weird little
rich man, poor man things.
There's, right. The ways but this that, is yes. Very rich. This is rich to the extent that your time has now been decoupled from your money, from the money that you make, you know? And once that happens, once that decoupling happens, you have reached enough money, you have enough money, like, say, if you have wealth, truly wealth, your money makes money, and your particular hours as an individual don't make a difference. Like, how you choose to spend your time makes no difference with how much money you bring in tomorrow.
Right.
That's the point at which children become okay again and people want to have them again.
But do they have them with the same woman? Are you talking about rich men that have children spread out by a number of different women? Because
I think
there's a limit to how many children
that,
one woman
also,
can have.
There's also the fact that the women themselves will have more kids even in that time. When that woman no longer has to think about the fact that, like, if you're rich enough that your career is totally irrelevant, like, having a career is irrelevant, it's just something you might want and you can really pursue any time in your life, but there is no economic pressure to make it happen. You know, it's the same reason we don't see, like, surgeons, female surgeons are a kind of a upper middle class thing. They're not a upper class thing, like, truly the upper crust women.
Well, yeah.
They're not
doctors
becoming surgeons.
In general are not an upper class thing, I wouldn't think. I mean,
right. But there's a lot of the highest salary, you know, kind of professions, they're not necessarily the kinds of professions we see people in the very, very, like, the actual wealthy.
No, they're not, they're not a leisure class. But I don't think that they're very wealthy women are going to have 12 kids or 8 kids.
They're not going to have 12, but they might have 3, right?
Oh, like, sure,
might
3. Have, yeah, what are we talking
about? That's what we're looking
sure.
for. That's
okay.
We just, we yeah,
would
well, just
like three. Three is like a flex now, right? Yeah, I do think that there's like a... No, I see that all the... Yeah, okay, but I know a lot of people with 3 kids. They're not very wealthy. They, you know...
Right. I mean, I'm not saying that
pretty average.
I'm not saying that it has to be. I'm saying that this is just what we're saying in, like, broader.
Yeah.
Like, these are the broader relationships, you know, and the difference is that if a woman feels that her time, which is like her childbearing years between from 20 to like 35, that it's important that she invest some of them in education, then she invests some of them in working up a kind of career for, you know, many reasons, like, yes, personal, like, I want this for myself reasons, but also that she has to. This is how she gets ahead. This is how she, you know, this is how she and her husband make it to the next class rung. Then she will do that. You know, she will spend 10 years of her childbearing years doing that. And then she only has 5 years to have as many babies as she could have. And that's a limited amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you get to be rich enough that either your husband can take care of all of it and you can just be a stay-at-home mom and it's not a big deal. Or that, you know, you're wealthy enough that it really doesn't matter for anybody. Then you can have kids. And it's not as difficult of a decision as I think it is for striver class people. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
like upper middle to upper middle kind of that. It's that cohort that has a really tough time making it work with kids, given the amount of time, the time investment that they have to put in order to make their lifestyle work.
I also want to talk about finding a partner, because one thing that comes up in the discourse a lot around this issue is the idea that people should not settle, but they should sort of have not have such unrealistic standards and think more seriously when they're in college or in their early 20s about finding a partner. Again, that's one of those things that I agree with in theory, but I think on a practical level, it's a lot harder to find a good partner than a lot of people realize, depending on your social circles. So here's a comment from this New York Times podcast. I'm Gen X and grew up middle class and had access to writing camp, museums, and college. Amongst my friends, all of whom went to great colleges and have excellent careers, probably half are married and fewer than that have kids. We were busy fighting to be taken seriously as professionals and be paid a living wage. And frankly, when many of us found partners, they weren't that great. I never wanted kids the way I wanted to go to grad school or see Australia. I know you love that, Sarah. Perhaps if it had been very easy to do and if I had found a truly supportive partner, I may have. But as it is, I live a very fulfilling life and an easier one than many of my friends who have to think about the cost of college for kids. Okay. Meanwhile, my paternal grandmother had 12 children, and I doubt that was her idea. Practically no one would choose the physical or economic wear and tear of having a huge family if they can avoid it. And now we can.
Mm-hmm. I think that last sentence is actually that's what it is. Mm-hmm. That we don't have huge families because we can avoid it because we have birth control, but that's only a little bit of it, because people would find ways to control, you know, their own family. You know, they would murder the babies if they needed to murder the babies. You know, it was an extreme kind of thing that you only did towards the end, but people made it happen. There were birth control methods. I don't want to exaggerate too much, because obviously we have an amazing amount of control now, and it has changed society. But even beyond that, we just don't need kids. You know, there's the fact that we have become prosperous enough and we have something called a pension plan. Like we can invest in our own future by saving. That alone has put us in a different position, in that we don't have to think about our old age and children together as a necessary thing. And people have, you know, I mentioned this before, and people said, well, you know, Sarah, in the West, it hasn't happened for a long time. And it's like, yeah, I know, you know, like I know that for a long time that has been decoupled. It is just increasingly less, you know, less the case. It's more and more separated, those two ideas. And actually in the West, our fertility rate has been going down for quite some time. And you can look back to where it started, where it began, the declining fertility, and it wasn't the sexual revolution. It's been at a downhill trajectory for much longer than that.
Yeah.
And I think that the real culprit is that we became prosperous enough that we didn't need as many kids to have a comfortable old age.
Right, right.
And they didn't need as many each other. You know, like you didn't need to have a little gang of siblings, because something happens to somebody, it's not that terrible in the first place.
Right.
But, you know, like it's
right.
Now we have diseases we can take care of. We can fix
it. Yeah, I mean, you're going to die in a farm accident. But
or get crippled in a farm accident and then you're a dependent.
Yeah. I thought some of these comments were interesting, and people were talking about large families and how they didn't see large families anymore. And a couple of people said that they hadn't even known large families when they were growing up. I thought that was so strange, because I knew so many families.
What do you mean, like, by large?
Like with six kids or something. Mm-hmm. Like I knew like so many like Catholic families, and they had five or six kids, and like that was not unusual when I was growing up. And I noticed somebody also said that they thought that kids who were from large families with a lot of siblings tended not to have kids or to have fewer kids. I mean, each kid is not going to have six kids, but I certainly know some families where there were a bunch of kids and all of those kids have kids, or most of them did. And I don't know. I mean, it's just so hard to generalize about these things.
Yeah, I don't think you can generalize.
I do think that people overlook the difficulty of finding a good partner. It's not like something that you can just follow a map and get right. There's a lot of variables, and especially now, we're talking about population crisis in the same, with the same breathlessness we're talking about the masculinity crisis, but these two things go hand in hand. And if women who want to have children can't find supportive mates, they're not going to have those kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
yeah,
what are we supposed to do?
They're definitely, that is another thing that's feeding into it. The fact that men and women just can't seem to get along very well, and younger men just aren't really developing. But I actually think it is that there is more of a, it's feeding into itself.
Yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I can imagine that our great grandfathers, if they had been put into a similar situation as men today, they would be like men today. Like, for many of them, it was just like growing up meant being suddenly having the responsibility of a family thrust on your shoulders, and then that is when you grow up. You know, like that is the force and the circumstance itself is what creates,
you know,
the man. And I just don't, it's not as if they were responsible fathers before they became fathers. They were, you know, they weren't
always responsible fathers after they became fathers. I mean, I don't disagree with you, but I think there's a romance, this, you know, you're describing, oh, it's made a man out of me, and like they're all going to kind of rise to the occasion. Some of them, sure.
Of course they all won't. I don't even think that there are bad parents out there. They're still out there. And I don't think that people who worry about the fact that they're going to be bad parents are the people that are going to be bad parents. I think it's the opposite.
Right.
But it is the case that even taking the part from the man angle of it, like the gendered angle of it, Jonathan Haidt talks about this all the time, about how our kids don't really grow up because they're not given the opportunity to test themselves and their limits. The growing up happens after you meet the challenge. You know, like there's a challenge that you can't yet overcome. You can't face it with whatever it is that you have within you in that moment. And you now are like, oh no, I want to meet this challenge. I want to be able to do this thing or overcome this thing. And then you grow. That's how growth happens. Growth doesn't happen without any external motivator at all for the majority of human population. That's just the way it is. And that's what we're seeing happen with kids in general. They're not growing up because they're not asked to grow up. They're not asked to take care of themselves. They're not asked to take any responsibility or have like mature kind of young adult activities. We don't allow them to do anything like that. And of course, they're just babies. They're just babies forever now, you know? And I think we're seeing some of that with young men, that we're not giving them that extra responsibility, and they respond by staying in that childhood, like 19-year-old gamer mode when they're 29 and in their parents' basement. So I totally see your criticism, where you're coming from, this, that there is a romanticism there of, you know, becoming a man, but really you become anything. This is how you change. This is how you grow. You have to encounter an obstacle and a challenge. And it used to be that it was expected that one of the challenges young men would have to face would be that they must provide for their families, and that forces them into a different mode of interacting with the world. And they make choices differently now that their environment has shifted. And of course, we're not going to see that. So I think that's what I mean with the self-fulfilling cycle aspect of it. Like, even some of these guys who could be helped are not going to be helped anymore. And then there's the other element that women can survive on their own. And so they are more choosy, and they have every right to be. And I hate the sort of right-wing online manosphere angle that tells women to just lower their sights and
don't
pick
be
them, I guess. Like, pick some online, like, posting creep. I just, I don't agree with that. At the same time, clearly there is some truth there. There is some truth to the fact that when women don't have to go for just anyone, they'll stop and they'll wait and they'll hope they can get somebody better.
Yeah, and I think in the past you did have people who had to get married. If you got your teenage girlfriend pregnant, you had to marry her. But there was also a pretty big chance that you were going to be cheating on her and actually not rise to the occasion, and your household is going to be in chaos and your family is going to be dysfunctional. I mean, who knows?
I mean, it's not the case that our past was just like deeply dysfunctional all the time and now we're super healthy. Like, no, I think we're deeply unhealthy now.
There was a lot of deception. I mean, people, I think that...
Deception, sure. Yes,
there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes in the past, TM, sure, that we have no idea about.
There was.
And people were stuck in situations and they had extended family to help them. Yes, that's true. And that was better. But I mean, I think some of what we're seeing now is just kind of like the contrast between what is unsaid and versus what is constantly talked about out in the open all the time, which is now. I mean, it's sort of like, it's like with the news cycle, right? It's not that the world is worse than it's ever been. It's just that we hear about every single thing that happens. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of true about our private lives as well.
Right. Like we only see we see what we have lost. But since we've already gotten used to what we've gained, it's human nature to focus on what we've lost. But I do think that I think the framing is a little bit misleading. And I guess this is how I have evolved a little bit personally and become more, I don't want to use that word, trad, because I hate those people online. Like I just can't stand them. They're so immature and LARPy and unforgiving and mean, really. But I think that I have become more sympathetic to that perspective as I've looked around me and seen how there's so many empowered people, educated, well-to-do. They have choices, so many choices about how they want to live and what they want to do. And really nothing is forced upon them, And I think that it might be surprising to see how psychologically unhappy or disturbed or uneasy they seem to be, when you might imagine that wasn't ever going to happen. Like just because you are, a 35-year-old woman and you don't have anyone in your life, or a 35-year-old man for that matter, and you have no one in your life and you're making money and you're doing well in your job. And so what, right? So what that you lose some of these traditional like family structures or whatever, because you have so many other things to be grateful for. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a truth to that, but I have a feeling that the things that we are losing, we don't see their loss as, like a sharp pain. It's not as if we've been stabbed.
It's a frog boiling in water.
Right. It's a deep, like fundamental unease, which is unlike the pains that we experienced in the past, which were much more, like vivid, and you could spot the source of it immediately. And at this point, I don't think we can spot the source of it. And I think that the people who are suffering the most would recoil from what would actually ease their tension, like what would actually ease their psychological stress.
So who are the people who are suffering the most? You're talking about people who are lonely and without
families? Like sort of these sort of high achieving or In the case of women, how achieving, and in the case of men, kind of losers. But
you think they recoil if you say you should find a partner and just hold your nose and get on with it? I don't know. I think a lot of them would say that is what I want.
Find a partner, but also like, I think for women don't recoil from partnership. They recoil from partnership with somebody that they don't see as worthy of them. And it seems like some of these younger guys, they are very resentful of the male role. And I don't think that they're willing to embody it the way that, you know, a true, you know, patriarch in the good sense would, you know, so there's that. That's what I mean. But you don't think that that's true?
Oh, I do think that's true. I agree with that. I think that the vast majority of people do want to have kids. I think part of what happens is that a whole bunch of stuff gets mixed up and confused in these conversations because, yes, a lot of people are choosing not to have kids for a variety of reasons. Occasionally, that reason is that they truly, truly don't want kids. They truly don't want to be a parent. It's not the right thing for them. I think that's maybe 10%, probably less. The vast majority of people feel that they would like to do it, but they're not up to it for some reason. They don't have the resources. They can't find a partner. I mean, that's huge. The number of women who say, I would have done this, but I just never found a suitable partner.
I know they say that. I know they say that, but I know some of these women. I know some of these women, and I know that they've been approached by men, decent men, just not men who are up to their standards for whatever reason. And it wasn't just from the woman's perspective. I've seen a lot of men also be stupid about and let good women go for, you know, just flimsy kind of reasons. I mean, it doesn't seem as if they're working at a relationship or they understand that a relationship isn't perfect right from the get-go and it's something you work towards and that there's, you know, trust gets built over time. And, you know, it's kind of this is a structure that we're building together. It doesn't seem as if that's how they're approaching
you mean the cornerstone versus the capstone marriage
right
idea.
I think they think of it as capstone. Someone should arrive in my life that is my equal or as the equal to the person I envision myself in my head to be, and everything will just sort of fall in place. And if it isn't falling in place immediately, if it isn't feeling right, quote unquote, and the vibes aren't good or whatever. Like, I mean, I don't want to paint too broad of a brush, but this is my personal experience. So take it for what it is.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of good people reject other good people or relationships that should have worked just sort of fall apart for stupid, flimsy reasons. And I can only think back to what we're sort of centering around, which is that now that you are living in a world where this is not as necessary, you know, this is kind of a choice thing. This is kind of something you opt into. And if you don't opt into it, well, you might be uneasy or something, but you won't die. You won't starve. You won't be a laughingstock. You'll still have a social network. You'll still have a world. You're not, you know, if you're a 60-year-old bachelor, it's weird and creepy, you know, that you're just hanging around certain social circles. But now it isn't, and that's okay, you know, and that's a good thing. So I think that people just, they have, the other choice is just easier to make. That's what it is.
The other choice to meaning what, to be alone?
Right, to say no to that next step that would lead to building of a family, whatever that might be. Maybe that's saying yes to the guy. Maybe that's saying yes to getting pregnant now versus in 2 years or 3 years. Like, we just... it's easier to say no because the other option is actually not unbearable, which is a good thing, right? Like, and I'm a liberal progressive in that sense where I think that's a good thing, but there is this indirect effect that is pretty bad. And it isn't the case that, you know, I think you're right when you say that people, it's not that people don't want kids. I think you're right that people do want kids. It's just that before it wasn't a choice for us necessarily in the same way that it is. And so we were forced into this thing that is like, you know, a hard good, quote unquote, you know, like a good thing that is like super painful to achieve.
And it was an inevitability. Yeah.
An inevitability. And it's also like, you kind of have to have society, like everything really forcing you into this direction. Otherwise, like you would just hesitate.
No, and they're, and that worked out well for some people. It made them happier in the long run. And sometimes it made them much less happy in the long run. I mean, here's the thing is, I don't disagree with you that people are walking away from opportunity because they have this idea that there's a limitless supply and the dating apps certainly enable this. But this has been going on since before dating apps. But I mean, not to pull rank, but I can tell you, as somebody who's been alive for 20 plus years longer than you have, I have seen again and again women and men, but probably mostly women, try to date, try to meet somebody, be willing to, quote, lower their standards, be willing to move, explore different cities, take classes, volunteer, do the right thing, you know, join the baseball league, try to meet men in every possible way. And it never, never, never happens. Some of them are never in a relationship. And these are attractive, educated, professional women. There's no rhyme or reason to it.
Well, I think so, those women actually are, they're faced with the lack of men at their level or even anywhere near their level. So that is a,
but that's a, they're just swimming in a big demographic. It's pretty major.
Yeah.
So I just think that, like, I mean, Anna Louise Sussman, I think is her name. She wrote a piece in the Times a couple of years ago, you know, saying all this, and Lori Gottlieb has talked about this, saying all these invocations to find a partner and marriage is good for you and marriage makes you healthy and marriage, you know, we have more longevity. Yes, that's all true. But finding a partner is really, really difficult.
It's getting harder and it's going to get just harder, right? Like for the same reasons that it's getting harder. So it's not, I'm not trying to say that this is, people are just making, they're just being lazy or they're being cowards or whatever. It's just that they have an option that their ancestors didn't have, and their ancestors would have taken that option too if they could have ended up in the same place.
And they would have had the same problems.
It's not as if people are like weak. This is like the obesity thing where it's like, the environment is different, you know, like the structure is different. And so the choices that individual people are making within that structure are different and perhaps harmful in a way that, you know, the same person would have made a different choice 100 years ago because they would have had a different like tray of options in front of them. So
the floral and fauna is different.
I don't think of it as a fault on the individual, but it is a problem that manifests at that level, like at the level of individual choices. And I don't want to just like stop and think about, okay, why aren't people getting married and like finding a guy, because that's one part of it, but they are not alone in, you know, the fact that the fertility rate is lowered. It's also the case that people who are married sometimes don't have children, and then if they do, they might only have one. So there's the rise of like the single child, like only child, you know, like that group has grown considerably.
Yes.
Also because of the same kind of factors, the same thing that's leading to fewer people getting married is what's leading to fewer married people having children, which is leading to fewer people who have children to have, you know, as many of them as they should be if we need to have the population soar again or even get anywhere close to non-devastating levels. And I've seen that in my own life, you know, like I've been married, like I've been with my husband for a very long time. Like, you know,
you
met
were very
him when
young.
I was married. I was a little child bride.
You have experienced very little single life. I think
I don't know single life.
That.
Yeah, I don't. Yes, you are. I met him when I was pretty young and have been with him since with like no breaks, nothing like that.
You should take a break sometime.
Well, you know, people break up for like a year and then they get back together.
Yeah,
we didn't do that.
It's like a sabbatical.
But you know, not only did we not, we didn't do that. So we had this like long period of time we were together, but we were spending a lot of that time not reproducing. You know, we were not. We took our time to get married. We took our time to start having kids. I mean, not in comparison to other people, but I'm just comparing it to my own life, like from the perspective of the fact that I've been with him for a very, very long time. I could have been like, you know, a very young mother, and I wasn't because I had other things to do. Okay. I had other things to do. I was running organizations. I was, you know, I had he has a career. I have a career. We have a social life. Like, there was always an excuse, and I don't even want to call it an excuse because it didn't feel that way.
But he's also much older than you. It's interesting he wasn't putting pressure on you because he wanted to get on with it.
Yeah. I mean, he was more ambivalent about kids in the first place.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is great
for
me.
Hey,
that's great for me. Well, now he's like in love with
super.
Yeah, I mean, super
sure he never should have done it.
Well, I think if he I should ask him about that. Like, would you do it again? But I think he's deeply in love with his children. So that's the, what are you going to do? Yeah, that happens. Sometimes it happens. But anyway, we took our time. And the reason we took our time was that we were, you know, a young couple that was educated, that had, you know, that was like dinking it or whatever, like, right?
Dinking is double income, no kids, just in case people don't.
Dual income, or right, something
dual,
like that.
Double.
But then whatever. It's a great place to be. That's a great place to be because you have so much money.
Yeah.
You have so much time and you can do, and you're saving money because you're living together. And so you're saving in a lot of ways, but then you still have all this money coming in. And it was a good little lifestyle that we had, and allowed us to pursue a lot of like hobbies. And, you know, I could write, I could speak, I could travel all the time, and it was no big deal. That was great. And you know, that was a wonderful choice that I had. And would I, you know, if someone had told me like, well, now you can get pregnant, if you wanted, you could get pregnant. You could just have more babies. It just didn't occur to me in that moment, you know? And it took a long time for that message to really hit. And I'm not surprised that that's the way it is for many people, and continues to be that way until they're like 37. And then it finally hits. This is a product of prosperity. This is a product of a lot of good things. And I don't think we should look back at those good things and say, these are bad things actually. But we should acknowledge that they have a role to play in what is turning out to be kind of a catastrophe. And so we need to think about a way to shift the structure again in a way that favors family formation.
I think we should encourage people to have larger families. I've said this before. I think it's less...
Some of us, you just want me to be barefoot and pregnant.
Yeah, that's what everybody wants in a podcast partner. No, I think that instead of trying to convince people who don't want kids to have them, allow people who want more kids to have them. I know so many people who say, oh, I wish I wanted more kids. I cannot tell you how many female friends I have. I mean, maybe partly it's because they're starting to get empty nest syndrome a little bit, not all of them. But they've got maybe two kids and they say, I really wanted four, I wanted three, and they just couldn't afford it. They mm-hmm. were living in cities and small apartments, and their husbands said, no more kids, or they aged out or whatever it was. So I think we have to think about it that way.
Or it has to be, I think it needs to shift at every level. Like, I think everyone needs to be prodded to move two steps forward, you know, like a little bit greater pressure on people who aren't married to get married, a little bit greater pressure on people who are, maybe pressure is not the way to phrase it, because I don't like the, like, let's coerce people into doing something that'll make them unhappy necessarily, but to, you know, provide kind of positive ways of entering this world, and of even recognizing how good it is. So like this podcast did bring that up a little bit, the Ezra Klein podcast, where, you know, one of the strategies they discussed was like how having children can be really quite wonderful, and it can be like a deeply fulfilling experience, and it is for many people. And so it might not be the worst thing to jump into it a little bit sooner than you're ready. And I think that might be, you could have coaching, you know, cultural coaching that makes it easier for people to take that harder step sooner without as much, you know, fear.
Yeah, I think it needs to just become more of a social norm. Look, people should do everything sooner than they do them. By definition, if you want to do something, if you think you're going to want to do something down the road, you should do it now.
I agree.
9 times out of 10, because everything takes longer than you think it's going to. And you don't live forever.
Have you read that essay in Palladium magazine about you should quit your job or something? It was like a couple of years ago. Yeah, it was published a couple of years ago. I love it. It popped back up on my like Twitter feed or something recently. But it was, I'll post a link to it in the show notes. But it's such a good essay. And it's just from this guy who founded the guy that founded the magazine. And he's basically like, yeah, just do it now. Like, do what you want to do and live that life right now. And because it's not the case that you can plan your way out of the difficulties of taking on a new role. You know, like it's, mm-hmm. and I think that's where we all get stuck. Like, if I only had this and this and this, then everything would be perfect.
Yeah, or I'm not ready for this. I think people delay things because they think, oh, I'm not ready to be a parent. I need to grow up and be wiser. I need to have more money. I'm mm-hmm. not ready to start this company because I don't know what I'm doing yet. Mm-hmm. I need mm-hmm. to go get educated. I need to do this. It's like, mm-hmm. you're never going to be ready. Like, buy mm-hmm. a house. Like, real estate is only going to go up. Buy a house. Don't wait until you can afford it. You're never going to be able to afford it. Just yeah. do it. I'm just using this as an example.
Yeah, yeah, but
like
yeah.
anything like that, it's better to struggle and be scared when you're younger than when you're older.
For sure. For sure. And it's also the case that failure is the best learning method and the best growing, you know, yeah. methods, the best teacher. And so the quicker you can fail, the better. And this is kind of the entrepreneurial mm-hmm. mindset, which is just like you want to just get things like ship the product out as quickly as possible so that you get feedback. So basically because you fail and somebody complains and then you know what to fix and then you fix that thing.
Build in public. And, yeah.
Well, right. But
that's true. I have a hard time with that though. I mean, that's,
I know.
As an artist, because I'm used to just like holding up, writing a book, you don't release a single page of it until it's behind, you know, between two covers.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a whole new ethos.
It's excellent. It's a great way of thinking about the world, which is just get it out there. Just fail. Fail as quickly as possible before the stakes are that high. You know, fail early.
Yes, right.
It's not as hard.
And people are more forgiving in the beginning. I think people are more forgiving of failure than we think, too.
Right.
I mean, as unforgiving as the world is in many ways now.
To fail.
What's that?
It's humanizing to fail.
It's humanizing. I mean, look, people are not forgiving over a bad tweet or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think
you get piled on for that tweet, maybe they'll be more forgiving, right? Like it's like
maybe
bad behavior that has no consequence. They won't necessarily.
Yeah, I think making a mistake and owning up to it quickly,
mm-hmm.
to saying, oh yeah, you know what, that was a mistake.
And I'm going to fix that, and here's how I fix. And now I'm not going to do that thing anymore.
Yeah, right?
Like I think it's an attitude that's really difficult, though. It's a difficult attitude. It's easy to talk about it, but then I try to apply it in my day-to-day life, and it is tough. It's just tough. But, you know.
Say, while you're thinking of something else to say, I will plug a couple of things I'm doing, including this co-ed unspeakeasy retreat in Chicago that is happening on June 4th and 5th. This is an example of something that might be a misfire. And that might end up being a huge mistake.
You're taking a big risk, and I'm going to forgive you.
That I might have to apologize for.
I've forgiven you.
Also, some people seem to think that this is going to be like some kind of singles event. It's not going to be huge. It's going to be a little bit bigger than our usual women's retreats. But mm-hmm. I think it'll have maybe 20 and 23 participants, and I'm going to try to do it evenly, men and women. It's almost full. But so if you're going to apply, I suggest you do so quickly. But we shall see. It might just turn into a bacchanal. We might have several marriages come out of it, for all I know.
How about arranged marriages? Huh?
Well,
how about that's the service you start? You do like an Indian style arranged marriage, and you have some like, you know, and it's like a matchmaker type thing. But mm-hmm. but you have to get married once they do mm-hmm. it. It's not about you and what you decide. I think that would be very relieving to people.
Actually, I think that's huge. I mean, taking the onus off of somebody, making them not accountable for their decision. I mean, again, it comes back to like the reason that people blame their choice not to have children on climate, because they don't want to just be accountable for saying, hey, I don't want to do this.
I also think there's just a general desire to be, you know, in anything, whether it's misfortune or even a good thing, even a blessing. I think we want to choose, but I think we want to be chosen, you know, like and I think that's partially why people end up being happier with parenthood, even when it's like a huge pain, because something about it, because this individual is new and unique and has never existed in the world, it feels like there's some, it's almost spiritual, like they have chosen you or the fates have chosen you to have this child. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that that's I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think and adoptive parents talk about that a lot, actually, that the child came to them.
Yeah, reason,
why this particular one at this time. And
right. And it's like mysterious. And yeah, who knows? It's just the way powerful. It came together. And then, yeah, I think that is also what we lose when we lose family structures to some extent and become so like mobile and empowered and able to. I mean, and I say this as somebody who's like just moved. I have no roots anymore. Right. Like I'm just moving around. But I think that saying that, oh, my ancestors were from this, you know, plot of land just over there. And we have this history with this place. And we have, you know, like the history of my parents and my great grandparents ties me down to this place. I think there is actually a satisfaction in that as well that we lose.
Yeah. I have none of that.
Oh well, I don't really feel that way, so I'm okay with.
Yeah, I have no idea where my ancestors are from. I'm also gonna shill for my class. The Unspeakeasy now has a course offering. Has three offerings. The Unspeakeasy School of Thought. We're offering three writing courses in fiction, screenwriting, and a genre that I invented. That soon you're gonna have to take my class to learn how to do, and that is writing your cancellation story. Cancellations can be large or small.
I think I'm not even fit to be canceled. You know what I'm saying?
No, yeah,
I was pre-canceled. Like I never made it.
You were canceled in the womb. You were you came out cancel proof. Yeah. So this isn't just about losing your career. You can be canceled in all kinds of ways: social exile and losing even your best friend over some culture war kind of thing. I was having people come to my writing classes trying to write these sorts of stories about what had happened to them. And I realized it should be a whole class. And the class is going to be taught by Sherman Alexie, who is a legendary writer, novelist, short story writer, filmmaker. He is Native American, one of the most important Native American writers of the last 30 to 40 years. And he's going to be teaching the class, which is unbelievable, actually. He had a cancellation event himself. So people should apply by going to theunspeakeasy.com and dragging down the School of Thought menu. This is a co-ed class. Co-ed class, not necessarily singles event. But
you know, wink, wink.
For everybody. It's like, oh, how did you two meet? Yeah, we were taking a how to write your cancellation story class together.
Aww, that would be a great story, actually. That would be a good story. This is better than my story. That's a good story.
You could have Louis C.K. officiate your wedding.
Aww.
Think of it. You could have an all canceled, bridesmaids and groomsmen. You could have Roseanne Barr be your maid of honor.
Oh. This is...
It's beautiful.
So it is beautiful, actually.
Okay. See, if that's not invitation to get married and settle down, I don't know what is.
All right.
So there you go. All right, everyone.
So sign up for that course.
Apply. You have to apply. Yeah.
Apply.
Apply. The classes start. Course. The class is running six weeks. It's on Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we also have fiction and screenwriting. Fiction, yeah. Screenwriting, and cancellation.
And rate and review the podcast.
Rate and review this podcast, please.
Please, please. Five star if you liked it. It would really help us. This is all I have. So Megan has so many other things going on, but this is the only thing I have going for me. And I really need it to work. Yeah. So
this is make or break for her.
All right.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.